Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my coat.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Today, Rabbi is joined by Elizabeth Poliner, an award-winning novelist and essayist and author of the new book, Spinning at the Edges. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. Happy Mother's Day, everybody. I know it's a Hallmark holiday par excellence, the leading cause of card sales in America, I'm told, but it's also a day, Mother's Day, dedicated to celebrating the simple biological fact without which none of us would exist, maternity. And while it's a darn strange way to reproduce when you think about it, messy, dangerous, unsanitary at times, it sure is essential for fulfilling the very first commandment in the Torah, Pru Urevu, be fruitful and multiply. And by golly, I'm awfully grateful that my mom decided to do it, may she rest in peace, as I suspect are you. Mother's Day is a great excuse to trot out all those stale, tired Jewish mother jokes, and while we are usually not above doing exactly that, this time on Too Jewish, I think we will rise above the temptation, for once, and concentrate on the lovely and wonderful quality of motherhood that is also so essentially Jewish. And so to play us in on this Mother's Day morning, here's the French Yiddish Gypsy world music group Les Yeux Noirs playing their jazzy rock version of My Jewish Mother.
A Yiddish mame Es gibt nicht besser in die Welt A Yiddish mame Oi, wei, wie bitte, wenn sie fällt. Wie schön und lichtig ist in uns, wenn die Mama ist du. Wie treurig finster wird, wenn Gott nimmt die Reufeule Mabu. Wasser und Feier Wollt sie gelaufen, fahr ich Kind Nicht halten ihr Taille Das ist gewiss die größte Sind Oi, wie glücklich und reich Ist der Mensch, was hat Als a scheine Matune geschenkt von Gott, als a altitschke jiddische Mame, Mame, Mai.
A Jewish mother is the best in the world. Through fire and water she'll help her own child. She is truly a gift from God. On Mother's Day, we recognize and celebrate that fact, no matter how many Jewish mothers it takes to screw in a light bulb. You know the answer, don't you? Never mind. I'll sit in the dark. In other news, we are in the last weeks of the counting of the Omer, the home stretch in the period between Passover and Shavuot, when our ancestors journeyed from slavery to freedom, and then from freedom to covenant at Mount Sinai. The holiday of Shavuot, Shavuos, begins Thursday night, May 21st, with a Tikkun Leil Shavuot, a study session. That's about 10 days from now. We have now tallied better than 5 of the 7 weeks that are counted daily as part of this period of preparation for Shavuot, the Festival of Weeks. But there are several minor holidays interspersed into our calendar, which break up the seriousness of this period of preparations and the counting of the Omer. For example, this Thursday, May 14th, is one of those joyous interruptions. It's the unusual festival of Yom Yerushalayim, Jerusalem Day. Now, this might be the most contemporary of all Jewish holidays, the very youngest of all our many festivals. Yom Yerushalayim, Jerusalem Day, commemorates the day in the year 1967 when the city of peace, Jerusalem, was united through war for the first time in 20 years. This year we will be celebrating the 59th anniversary of the liberation of Jerusalem, if you can believe it, and the return of access to the holiest of all Jewish places in the world, the Kotel, the Western Wall. Yom Yerushalayim rejoices in the reunification of Jerusalem that tied together the city which is the eternal capital of the Jewish people and the heart of all Jewish spirituality. God, the psalm tells us, if I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand lose its skill. May I always put Jerusalem above my chiefest joy, al rosh simchati. In honor of this upcoming festival of Yom Yerushalayim, here on Two Jewish, we're going to play the greatest of all Jerusalem songs, still. Naomi Shemer's seminal Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, Jerusalem of Gold, as sung by Shuli Natan, the very first singer of this classic composition, past guest of Two Jewish. Tardimat ilan va'even shvuya b'chaloma ha'ir asher badad yoshevet u'veliba choma Yerushalayim shel zahav v'shel nechoshet v'shel or alo lecho Shuk reka Vein pokedet har habayit Ba'ir ha'adika Uva me'arot asher basela Me'alelot ruchot Vein yored el yam ha'melach Bederech yericho Yerushalayim shel zahar Yerushalayim shel zahav That was the classic Israeli song Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, Jerusalem of Gold, in honor of the 59th anniversary of the reunification of Jerusalem, which we will celebrate this coming week. Yerushalayim Shel Zahav is still maybe the most beautiful song ever, celebrating the unique and meaningful city, Jerusalem. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest this morning will be author Elizabeth Poliner, whose prize-winning first novel has now been succeeded by her excellent new book, Spinning at the Edges. We'll hear all about it when we come back in a moment on To Jewish. We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Elizabeth Poliner is the author of a new novel, Spinning at the Edges, her second novel. Is that correct?
It's my second novel. It's my third work of fiction. My first was a book of connected stories, linked stories.
They're kind of a linked story connection. The second was her novel, As Close to Us as Breathing. And the new book is a fascinating and beautifully written book that touches on many complicated subjects. And we'll talk about that now. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Just a couple of loose questions. You set this in the year 2000. Why?
I set it in 2000 originally because that's when the first character came to my imagination, and that was Stephanie Pearl. And it happened to be in the year 2000, and Bush versus Gore gradually was ensuing that year, and I just associated her with that year, and she had a fascination with the law case, which I ultimately transferred over to her mother. But originally it was Stephanie who was interested in the law case. So I didn't start writing the book then. I started writing it many years later, but I still had that sense of Stephanie being in the year 2000. And that was originally why that time period emerged. But it ended up developing over time. I thought there was an interesting juxtaposition between the law theme in that year, which is Bush versus Gore, and the law theme that emerged when I began writing the backstory set in Amsterdam, 1941-42.
You know, there's been an interesting focus in recent months even on legal cases. I was thinking of the film Nuremberg, you know, some of the legal aspects. That's certainly not at, well, I don't know, I wouldn't say it's not at the heart of your story, but it is a really interesting facet that I think people don't talk about much. What intrigued you so much about it?
I think at first it was a way that Stephanie is the daughter of a Holocaust survivor,
right,
doesn't feel she can unburden herself fully on her mother, whose emotions she's always, in a sense, protecting. So they talk about that instead. It's sort of the big news at the time. But it was the Nazi, anti-Jewish Nazi laws that got me more deeply invested into the theme of law. And that was how they did their work, law by law by law. I mean,
right,
they took over by force. That was how they did their work. And I really couldn't write the book or write that part of the story without immersing myself in the timeline of the laws, which then became part of the story. It became part of what I imagined and part of the story. And that, it just sort of developed over time that with a theme like that in the backstory, I needed to think a little harder about Bush versus Gore and get into the case itself, the reasoning of the case. And all of a sudden, it sort of became clear to me that they're connected loosely, but they're connected in the sense that there's a warning in Bush versus Gore that when America steps away from democratic norms and practices, it could be quite dangerous. The backstory is an example of just how dangerous that gets. So that hasn't happened yet by a long shot in the time period of Bush versus Gore. But there's just a hint of that in the book by juxtaposing these two things.
Yeah, it's fascinating. We will talk much more about that and what it means in so many ways in some of the relationships and skating, I think, too, when we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish.
Nine, 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 nine.
Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this spring and summer. Established more than 7 years ago by wonderful congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for Shabbat services in person or on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests always in our sanctuary and in our classes. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious school is going great for school-age children and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Torah Tykes program for the youngest kids, Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events are open to everybody. Come in person Friday night, 6:30 p.m., Shabbat evening celebration services, always followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat and homemade challah. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. with services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimchaTucson. And our musical services are in person and, of course, online. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those through the website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, and Torah Tykes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, all taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona. While we are still a week or two before American Memorial Day, we commemorated Israeli Memorial Day with Yom HaZikaron just a couple weeks ago. I wanted to play a lovely song, often sung at Yom HaZikaron, remembering those who are gone, thinking of how we ourselves will be remembered. Ma Enoshit Echad. Here's an amazing version of it by Yonatan Rozel and Avraham Tal.
להתחיל מההתחלה
And now it's time for a recurring, inscrutably irregular feature of Too Jewish, wisdom from Zen Judaism. Drink tea and nourish life. With the first sip, joy. With the second, satisfaction. With the third, peace. With the fourth, a cheese Danish. And wherever you go, there you are. Your luggage, that's another story. From the eternal wisdom of Zen Judaism. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, for those of us who travel and observe Jewish dietary laws in one form or another, either strictly kosher or we'll eat out, but we only eat fish or vegetarian, or some people keep kind of a biblical kashrut, they won't eat pork or shellfish, but other things, it presents some interesting challenges, and some of those challenges are not international. You have a story for us today.
Right, absolutely. So this morning I had breakfast at a hotel restaurant that I go to fairly often. And it was the first time I'd been there in about a month. And the last time I was there, I asked to speak to the restaurant manager because I discovered in the most roundabout way possible that the hamburger, which I always assumed was 100% beef and which listed optional toppings of pork belly, lettuce, tomato, onion, pickle, and a couple other things, special sauce, whatever. I always assumed that like most burgers in the U.S., it was 100% beef. And so as long as I didn't have cheese or dairy at the same meal, it meets my minimal standards of keeping kosher. So I discovered recently by chance that actually the pork belly is in the burger itself and that none of the servers were aware of that, or they just hadn't told me when I said without the pork belly that the pork belly is intrinsic to the burger. So I complained a month ago to the restaurant manager. I saw her today for the first time. I said, so what were you able to get done? And she said, well, the chef refuses to change the way he makes burgers. But what I did do was I went over with all the servers the fact that the pork belly is in the burger and they should tell people this, especially if there's international guests, which there often are at this hotel, at the time of the gym show, whatever. Because whether they're Muslims or Jews, it's relevant to them. It may not be hugely important, but it's definitely relevant. Is there pork in it or not? And she said she had done all she could because she can't influence the chef. She told me to speak to the GM. So I did speak with the GM. And he actually thanked me profusely for bringing this to his attention. He said, you know, it's the first time this problem's been brought to my attention. And you're right. It's a valid problem. And we should be sensitive to the needs of all our guests who do come from all over the world. So then I thought about, you know, my world travels and how sometimes there are hidden traps. Like in Southeast Asia, the most common hot sauce is something called sambal. And unexpectedly, ground up in this red hot sauce is shrimp. So I can never eat sambal. There are lots of things I can eat. And Southeast Asia is particularly easy because there's so many vegetables and so much fresh fish.
Fresh fish, vegetarian. Right, of course.
And the thing that's called oyster sauce, in fact, doesn't have any oysters.
There's no oysters, no shellfish at all in it, actually.
Right.
The
a misleading name.
You know, it's funny. It's partially, you know, it's a Jewish issue, but interestingly, it's somewhat different, but a similar issue for Muslims in terms of, you know, if they only eat halal meat, they run into some of the same problems, except they get to eat shellfish. I've often felt
right.
Like maybe they're right on that subject, but never mind. I digress.
Right.
Tom, is there any particular country that you've traveled in which is extremely difficult to find food in that doesn't have pork?
I can't say recently because I haven't been there recently. But in the old days, Russia used to have these extensive menus in hotels that were designed for foreign tourists. And they were encyclopedic. But it turns out they generally had only one thing on the encyclopedic menu. So you learned after two or three days not to bother reading the menu, but just to say, what do you have today? And it would generally be biftek, which is any kind of meat disguised, like ground up and colorlessly cooked and whatever. So I ended up making many meals in Russia out of dark rye bread and spicy mustard and nothing else.
A little bit limiting. Tom, thanks so much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. As Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah are playing Mahjong one day, Sarah suddenly says, "Girls, I have a confession to make. We've known each other for many years. I feel I can now tell you my secret. I'm a kleptomaniac. But there's no need to worry. I've never stolen from any of you, and I never will. Other people, okay, but not you. You're my friends." At that, Rivka says, "Okay, since we're having a confession session, I have to admit I'm a nymphomaniac. But there's no need to worry. I've never tried to sleep with any of your husbands. I never will. You're my friends." "Well then," says Rachel, "I'd like to admit that the reason I never married is I'm a lesbian. But no need to worry. I will never make a pass at any of you. You're my friends." Finally, the fourth woman, Leah, stands up and says, "Girls, I too have a confession. I'm a yenta. I love to gossip. And boy, do I have phone calls to make." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and, you know, make some phone calls. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Bamidbar, the first one in the book of Numbers, given its name for the census that occupies a good part of the beginning of the Torah portion. Superficially, it's just a listing of names and numbers, and not a very interesting text for study or inspiration, but it also teaches a primary lesson. Every human being counts in God's eyes, and should similarly count in our eyes as well. There's an unusual phrase at the beginning of Bamidbar. The survey is to be taken of the entire nation, b'mispar shemot, by the numbering of names. In other words, even though, by definition, a census is an accounting, totaling of sums, every individual is to be accounted for, not by number, but by name. Each person has a unique identity, a human face. Each is an image of God. The notion that every human being counts is part of our tradition in many ways, from the requirement that we have 10 Jewish adults for a minyan to the requirement we must view every other person as a tzelem Elohim, an image of God, no different from ourselves in holiness. The Talmud tells us that one who saves a single life is accorded the merit of having saved the whole world. Each of us must be counted because we all count. Paradoxically, even counting itself can be transformed into an affirmation of sanctity. In this period between Pesach and Shavuot, of course, we count each day of the Omer as a kind of special preparation, remembering the connection between freedom and covenant. We count each day so that we will make each day count. And when we do the tabulation that lets us know we have the 10 required for a minyan, traditionally we don't count by numbers, since that would devalue each human being into a mere digit. Instead, we find a verse from the Bible, the Tanakh, that has 10 words, and we work our way through it until we have completed the passage, thus making every member of that accounting into part of a holy sentence. In a world made up of numbers, it's comforting to realize we are much more than just the sum of our names. No matter how we seek to quantify and digitize our world, each of us, especially you, matters to God and should matter to every other person. And that is worth recounting again and again. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, Elizabeth Poliner, will explain how she crafted her new novel, Spinning at the Edges, and how the law and justice play a crucial part in it both. Hear all about it when we come back in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world, with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
A diplomatic fight erupted after Belgian prosecutors moved to charge two Mohalim, Jewish men performing traditional Brit Milah ritual circumcision, which prompted Israeli and U.S. officials to accuse Belgium of targeting Jews for practicing, you know, Judaism. Gideon Saar, Israel's Minister of Foreign Affairs, lit into the country, calling the indictments a scarlet letter on Belgian society. With this act, Belgium joins a short and shameful list, together with Ireland, of countries that use criminal law to prosecute Jews for practicing Judaism, Saar wrote. He called circumcision, which it is, a cornerstone of Jewish faith, and urged the Belgian government to act immediately to find a solution. Saar's condemnation was quickly joined by the U.S. ambassador to Belgium, Bill White, who previously called on Belgium to drop the ridiculous and anti-Semitic investigation of Moyles in February. This is a shameful stain on Belgium, White wrote. Prosecution of these religious figures, Moyles, one of whom is American, is wrong and won't be tolerated. Belgium will be thought of now as anti-Semitic by the world. Until this is resolved, there is no way around it. White added that the Trump administration condemns this judicial action and called on the Belgian government to work with Jewish leaders and communities to find a certification solution immediately. The condemnation by White and Saar comes after the Antwerp Public Prosecutor's Office announced it intends to prosecute two Jewish men on charges related to performing circumcisions, a practice required by law to be performed by licensed medical professionals in Belgium. Last year, Belgian authorities raided multiple sites, including two in Antwerp's Jewish quarter, at the beginning of an investigation into quote-unquote illegal circumcisions, that is, Brit Milah, as performed by Moyles for 3,800 years by Jews. Investigators also requested lists of children who had recently been circumcised in Belgium. Perhaps they were intending to prosecute the infants, too. Sharp criticism by the two leaders was dismissed by Belgian Foreign Minister Maxime Prevot, who wrote in a reply to White's post, it was inappropriate to publicly criticize a country and tarnish its image simply because you disagree with judicial proceedings. It is no surprise to find European nations with a long and evil history of endemic anti-Semitism attacking Jewish religious practices. Belgium, and Ireland for that matter, fall into that category. There are still anti-Semitic parades held in Belgium, all in good fun, you understand, and the Belgian record during the Holocaust was frankly atrocious, even if most people don't remember that. Anti-Semitism is in the very soil of Europe. The attacks on kosher slaughter in the Scandinavian countries and on Brit Milah in Belgium, Ireland, and elsewhere is another symptom of it. In better news, however, from Brussels, more than 650 years after Jews in Brussels were executed and expelled following false anti-Semitic accusations, church officials at the Cathedral of St. Michael and St. Gudula have installed a plaque apologizing for the persecution commemorated in the stained glass windows there. At a ceremony back on April 27th, Archbishop Luke Terlinden of Mechelen, Brussels, and Rabbi Albert Guigui, the chief rabbi of Brussels, unveiled four plaques written in Dutch, French, English, and Hebrew, providing historical context for the windows and apologizing for the anti-Semitic persecution tied to the events they depict. The plaques, which Terlinden himself signed, state that baseless accusations of the desecration of the Eucharistic host were made against Jewish communities in medieval Europe, and the accusations led to persecution, massacre, and unjustifiable expulsions. The stained glass windows show Jews being executed at the stake in response to their alleged attacks on the Eucharist. bread that Catholic doctrine considers a literal representation of Jesus' body. Theological and social anti-Judaism is in direct contradiction with the gospel of Christ, which calls for truth, justice, and brotherhood, the plaques say. We ask forgiveness from the Jewish people for the suffering these accusations caused. The stained glass windows in the cathedral depict the Brussels host desecration, an anti-Semitic accusation in the year 1370. The Jews had desecrated communion wafers that led to the execution of Jews in Brussels and the expulsion of the entire city's Jewish community. The windows have drawn scrutiny for many decades, particularly as the Catholic Church sought to reckon with its deep history of anti-Semitism. In 1969, the Archbishop of Brussels ordered several paintings removed and a plaque mounted to offer context about the remaining depiction. Several years later, Catholic leaders finally installed the plaque that drew readers' attention to the biased nature of the accusations and the legendary presentation of the quote-unquote miracle. But Flora Kasson, the director of the Brandeis Center for Jewish Studies and a scholar of European anti-Semitism and an upcoming guest of Too Jewish, said the existing plaque was very ambiguous about the responsibility and installed in an easy-to-miss location. The new plaques contain a clear and very moving apology. It cannot be missed by anyone who comes to see the windows. The significance is enormous of the church finally putting a plaque there that tells the story, acknowledges the anti-Semitism behind it, acknowledges it was a slander that resulted in persecution and the execution of Jews in Brussels and their expulsion, said Kasson. Speaking of anti-Semitism in Europe, there was a horrible stabbing incident in the Jewish London suburb of Golders Green last week, in which a Somali man of dubious sanity stabbed two Jewish men, one in his 30s, one in his 70s, for no reason beyond anti-Semitism. There were also arson attacks on Jewish ambulances, as well as a variety of other incidents in England over the last few weeks. In response, London's Metropolitan Police launched a 100-officer unit to protect Jewish communities. Arrests have followed in rapid succession. The London police believe Iran is responsible for at least some of the anti-Semitic terrorist attacks on Jews in London. They've arrested about 50 people over the last 4 weeks in connection with anti-Semitic hate crimes. 8 have been formally charged.
And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back the Too Jewish. Our guest this morning, Elizabeth Poliner, is the author of the new book, Spinning at the Edges, an award-winning author. This is her second novel. It's a rich and beautifully rendered book. I mentioned skating because it plays a big role in this. And I don't know if they still are able to skate with all the global warming, but in the Netherlands, it was a big deal for a long time, and it is central. Do you skate?
I used to. I grew up in a little town, a little bit like the town in the novel, a small New England town with a lake. We also had a bog that we skated on. We skated on the lake, on the bog, sometimes at a nearby rink, inside rink at Wesleyan University. So I did grow up skating and loving to skate outdoors, but I was never an accomplished skater, nothing like that, but I just liked it. I lived in Washington, D.C. for a number of years, and a friend and I used to take an evening a week every so often and go to a rink and just talk as we skated. It was just a wonderful way to talk and get some exercise. And that became the inspiration for Stephanie and her friend Rona going skating at the Wheaton Rink outside of Washington, D.C.
There's a powerful aspect in this book about second generation survivors. There's a great deal. Now we're up to fourth generation survivors in some ways. Tell us a little bit about your exploration of that, because the aspect of Stephanie not being able to talk to her mother about her experience, that's pretty normal for second generation people. Can you explore that a little bit for us?
Sure. Before I wrote the book, I stumbled upon an article about how the DNA of children of Holocaust survivors was shown to carry the trauma of the parent or parents who lived through the experience. And that study really captured my attention, and it seemed to mirror just what I could observe about life. And so I was interested from the beginning in the intergenerational aspect of the trauma that ensued with the Holocaust. And I guess as I was thinking about Stephanie, I really just imagine Ruth closed down still, just containing it all and never really processing her trauma and therefore needing to be so kind of closed, you might say, emotionally closed. And of course, part of the novel is she stares at her lake view, which is very consoling to her, a very consoling piece of nature. And Stephanie has just grown up with this mother, and she's just learned to cope with her, you know, to be independent, to mother the mother when necessary, and ultimately not to share her pain. That's just something she unconsciously decides, I think, at an early age, that her mother's too fragile. And so this is really the great sorrow of Stephanie's life, that she can't share herself and her pain with her mother because she's always protecting her mother and putting herself second, you might say. So that's really how I got into it. It was just by imagining Ruth that led to what was going on with Stephanie. And there's actually another generational tear to all this. In the immediate aftermath of Ruth's sister's murder back in Amsterdam, the mother, Tessa, also shuts down. So Ruth is affected by her mother, too. So there's really three generations that I'm working with on that thread.
You know, that experience of trauma, it's fascinating. I guess I haven't read that study about it affecting the DNA, but it certainly has a generational carryover. And it's funny because in the Bible, it talks about how, and the Torah talks about how it carries from the third and fourth generations. And I think that's accurate enough. In exploring that, you find, and I don't want to, you know, kind of reveal too much, but there's a remarkable incident in which they get together, she and the judge, and save a guy from, I mean, it's kind of the core of the novel, right? Tell us about that redemptive experience a little bit.
It is redemptive. I appreciate your saying that. One day, while at her home on the lake in this little town in Connecticut, Ruth is about to go ice skating. She's a skater from her childhood. And she looks up and she sees a boy, and he's kicking at the ice, and then he disappears into the ice. And as it happens, a judge from another town who's come to the little town that day sees it too. So from different directions, they both race out to help this boy, and they save his life. And it is redemptive. It brings them into relationship. They're all isolated people, the boy, Ruth, and the judge. They're all isolated in their pain. And suddenly they're in relationship with each other because of this incident. And with time, it grows into friendship, and some inadvertent healing grows out of that. But for Ruth, it's redemptive because she couldn't do anything. She was helpless to help her sister back in the day.
Right.
And both kids are 16-year-olds, and they're both suffering from love, absence of love in their life, struggling with their love relationships in different ways. So there's a parallel there, a, you know, kind of intentional parallel there. So it's very much a second chance, you might say, for Ruth to do something and help somebody just the same age as her sister, whom she couldn't help as a kid. And for the judge, it's likewise redemptive. He, too, had a rough, rough past and couldn't help himself. He couldn't help his mother and his sister from his father. So he gets something out of helping the boy, too. And the boy, of course, gets the connection to both of them, which is extremely helpful to him.
The awful Holocaust memories don't emerge for a little bit, but they do show up, of course, in the course of the book. How did you decide when to let that reveal take place?
I think I just felt it out. The structure, as you know from reading it, is a little bit unusual.
Yes, it is.
And I think I just felt it out about the timing, when the right timing for that was. But Ruth is certainly having memories throughout of her childhood, and they're triggered at times by different events. When she sees the boy, for example, kicking at the ice, it reminds her instantly of her sister kicking a tree at Oosterpark once they were banned as Jews from going there. So it just really emerged organically when I thought the story was asking for it.
You highlight, I don't know, is it called headers or sort of, about the anti-Jewish laws?
Yeah, I do. Openers or headers. I was talking about them all the time. It's headers.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I don't know. I'm no expert in this, but it is very interesting how you kind of intersperse at the start of each chapter one of these anti-Jewish laws. as awful as the Nazi takeover was, I don't think people understand how they systematically subjugated each country they captured, starting with Germany itself, of course, through these, what's the analogy? You know, you can have the frog or in boiling water and it doesn't jump out because the water's tepid and then it gradually heats up until it dies. It's sort of like that, isn't it?
It is. It is. The laws are like a slowly forming noose. You know, each law makes the noose a little tighter and tighter and tighter until there's mass destruction of the Jewish community and mass death. They're how the Nazis did their work. So I thought they were really, really important and important to get specific to about them. When I could, I included who generated the law and what department from which it, what are the different departments of the Nazi regime which generated different laws, because I thought the titles of those departments and the title that a certain person might have also spoke to the, what I call the contemptuous authority that the Nazis had over the Jews. So they're a big piece of it, and I appreciate the question very much. It's very much, I got interested in how they did what they did.
Yeah, things like Commissioner General for Security or Secretary General of the Department of such and such. You know, they're all very super official sounding.
Super official sounding, and look what they were doing.
Of course. Doesn't sound too different from some of the government names that we use today, does it?
Yeah, you have to be careful. There's so many parallels. You have to be careful when you see a name changing. Like, what does that mean? Think about it.
And by the way, I think the guy that had to help her do the rescue had to be a judge or a lawyer, didn't he?
I guess he did. It's helpful that he is. He gets to explore law a little bit that way. Yeah, he's to my mind, I have a lot of affection for these characters, even though they're pretty broken people. These are the characters that
right.
More contemporary part of the story. And he's there. He isn't there specifically to speak about law. I always conceived of him as a judge because of the issue with the view, the lake view. He was going to help with that. That was really where his being a judge came in. But then as I got more involved in thinking about Bush versus Gore, he was thinking about it too, as it turned out. So he's helpful to me as a writer for a number of reasons. But his tragic past is very much part of the story too, and how he can kind of see Bush versus Gore as maybe suggesting something very dangerous, because he, on a personal level, has suffered under the authority of a tyrannical authority figure, his father. He's the one with a sensitivity about all that.
You know, without getting too overtly political, because you're very subtle about it, I think, in the book, not about the Nazis, but about the parallels, Bush versus Gore now seems kind of benign in contrast to what's gone on in recent years. Can you draw that parallel a little bit?
Yeah, I think you're right. It's benign relative to what's going on now, but I think it's kind of a toe in the water to what's going on now. It sort of suggests the possibility of things that are going on now, the possibility being that the norms of democracy can be weakened to the point where, you know, some pretty dangerous stuff is happening. So even though it's not happening then, there's a suggestion of that. And the way I see it, or the way I even feel it when I read the book, there's that combination of Bush versus Gore, plus the backstory with what the Nazis did, really hints at, really draws out a little bit of the feel of what's going on today. It's not, we're not there. I don't want to suggest we're there, but there's just so much going on today that is of concern that perhaps Bush versus Gore hints at, just simply hints at.
You know, you do a really delicate job of balancing, as we talked a lot about the legal aspects, but most of this book is really about, as you noted, broken people, damaged people trying to find healing and redemption. How did you balance all of that? Because it's well done, but was it systematic, or did it just evolve that way?
It really just evolved. Much in the writing is an evolution. It's a process. The first pair of broken people I was thinking about was Stephanie and her mother, right, and that relationship. And then again, the Lakeview issue came in pretty early, and I realized a judge would be involved to help Ruth. The book started differently. There was a legal case at the beginning about that. It doesn't even exist anymore, but that's how how Arthur Cantrell got involved, but he evolved into a person with a really damaging past as well. And with time, I began to see all the characters that way. They each had their wound. And in the novel, they feel it's happening again in different ways. Ruth Pearl thinks it's happening again when Bush versus Gore comes down, and she sees the case as silencing people's votes, and that threatens her. It reminds her of her past when all the Nazi laws came down and stripped the Jewish community of their rights. But Arthur Cantrell, too, when he has an ethics complaint filed against him, right. He thinks it's happening again because he feels like he's being chased. That's what it feels like to him. It feels just like his father's after him again. And you can go through almost all the characters and find their it's happening again moment. And they are broken people. And that's what I was dealing with in this book, just this little crowd of broken people who I cared about a lot. I think of them still as very tenderly toward them.
You know, I think good novels don't usually have whole perfect people. It's just not.
Yeah.
It doesn't make for good fiction. It just doesn't.
Right. And broken people do things that you don't want them to do, but they do it out of their brokenness.
And you're fascinated to watch. So I want to thank Elizabeth Polliner for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called Spinning at the Edges. Where can people go to find out more about you and the book?
They can go to my website, www.elizabethpolliner.com. They can go to any of the booksellers to read about the book online, and they can go to Harper Books to find out more about it as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be David Hirschberg, author of the new novel, Crossing the Bronx. And join us, Congregation Beit Simcha, each Friday night. Services and Onig Shabbat at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush in person and on our Facebook page. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org for services and class schedule, and to sign up for our new wonderful Torah Tykes membership for the youngest kids. You know, the European Eurovision Festival is on again soon, the annual musical competition Israel often does well in. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from last year's Israeli entry into Eurovision. It's called A New Day Will Rise, sung by Yuval Raphael in English, French, with just a little bit of Hebrew. My friends, may you have a good week, a healthy week, and a week, we pray profoundly, of justice and of peace.
And even if you say goodbye, you'll never go away. You are the rainbow in my sky, my colors in the gray, my only wish upon a star, sunshine in the day, the only song that my piano ever plays. And even if you say goodbye, you'll always be around to lift me up and take me high, keep my feet close to the ground. Are you proud of me tonight? Dreams are coming true. I choose the light, nothing to lose if I lose you. New day will rise, life will go on. Everyone cries, don't cry alone. Darkness will fade, all the pain will go by.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.
Même si je dis adieu, tu ne partiras jamais. Mon conciel dans mon ciel bleu, mes couleurs dans le gris. Mon se souhaite sous un ciel tard, un rayon de ma journée. La seule chanson que mon piano peut jouer.